There are eight main islands in the Hawaiian archipelago, one of which is Kaho'olawe. What was once an ancestral home for Native Hawaiians became a U.S. military test site as chemical agents, bombs, mines, and more weapons were deployed, destroying virtually all vegetation and all wildlife on the island. In fact, to simulate an atomic blast, 500 tons of TNT was detonated, not only creating a sizable crater, but also cracking the water table beneath, forever changing the hydrology of the landscape, because that means the groundwater was forever lost to sea. Native Hawaiians and locals reclaimed the island through a series of occupations in the 70s, and a few years ago, I had the privilege of going to Kaho'olawe with a grassroots organization dedicated to healing the land. The night before we left, we prepped and slept in sleeping bags in the open air on the shores of Maui. And after a 5 a.m. wake-up call, we arrived to the dock where a small speedboat would take folks across a little stretch of ocean in three separate trips. And I was in the group that would go last. As we waited, we watched the sky turn with the sunrise. It was near noon when the empty speedboat finally returned for us, the final group. Not too much time had passed before the wind picked up and the waters got rougher, and I looked out on the opposite side of the boat and saw the smooth back of a whale not 10 feet away. It soon retreated into the deep blue depths below us, but we stared at each other, some familiar faces, some strangers, but with wide eyes and wide grins. We didn't think it got much better than that until another whale back appeared, and another. And soon, a humpback whale decided to make a full grand entrance, breaching in the wake of the boat just several feet behind the boat. And as the boat retreated, the whale continued to breach, almost in the same spot, but we soon turned our sights to the rocky red land of Kaho'olawe. Unlike the other Hawaiian islands where there are sandy beaches and more shades of green than you can ever count, Kaho'olawe had rocky shores and red dirt that was hard-packed, its topsoil gone, leaving almost nothing but invasive thorny small trees and grasses. Coming off this excitement over the breaching whales, it was a different kind of sacred feeling pulling up to the island. The whales, a sign of abundance of life in the water, was a stark contrast to almost a lack of life on the island. But before we could unload our bags or step off the boat, rather jump off the boat than step off, we had to stand in the boat that was now being terribly rocked by the ocean wind and waves and chant together. It was a Hawaiian chant that asked for permission to enter the island, and the organization that led the trips writes this on their website. The receiving individuals on land are bound by obligations of hospitality to grant permission to the visitors if the olikahea, the chant, is delivered properly. A rejection to land by the receiving party is possible. If we chanted like we weren't sure whether we wanted to be there or if our intentions were not appropriate, the cultural practitioner could ask us to go back. Chants and prayers are often recited to allow the mind and consciousness to move from the mundane space to the sacred. And it was easy for the mind to get distracted by our tense bodies trying not to fall overboard. But staring at the island and the possibility that the next 4 days would bring brought a sense of purpose and calm. And I channeled that into chanting from a place of strength and openness, but also humility as an outsider and guest. Part of the words in the chant translate to this. Indeed, a rough and crashing sea, how is it that one lands? It is the voice. Please don't hold back the voice. In this chant, the unpredictable and chaotic ocean is acknowledged and expresses the question about how to overcome it, and it points us to something larger than ourselves that instills in us the power to persevere, even when the foundation moves beneath our feet. I see many parallels in this chant to the scripture in Matthew that was read. When Peter sank into the sea after walking a few short steps, Jesus asked him, "Why did you doubt?" Not, "Why were you afraid?" I think there's a key distinction there. We cannot accomplish something bigger than ourselves if we don't acknowledge the parts that we're ashamed of. It's okay to be afraid. It's okay to come with baggage. It just matters how you begin. And because I love literary analysis, I'd like to point out that Jesus does not refer to what Peter was doubting, faith in Jesus to keep him above the water or faith in himself. I like to think it's the latter, probably not, I know, but just humor me. I'd like to think it's the latter, because Peter reaches up and says, "Lord, save me," suggesting that he knew it was Jesus and that he could be saved. So was it doubt in his own abilities to carry out what Jesus encouraged? We don't have to be fearless to reach beyond and grasp onto that larger-than-self thing, whether that's God, community, connection to the earth, whatever that looks like for you. Not acknowledging our shadow selves when walking on the rocky seas or entering a culturally significant island are sure ways of barring entry into the sacred. And this contradictory stance of turning inward to expand beyond the selves helps me stand in the face of adversity. The experience is made even more holy when my stance is not one of denial of the rocky seas or our shadow, but one of vulnerability. Water has the power to destroy. It pounds and crashes against the rocks without a care of what it carries in its waves. The seeming sense of chaos reminds us of floods that humble us, the water pooling where the land tells it to, almost like a memory. We may drain wetlands to pave lots and build buildings, but water remembers where it once was and where it should go. This type of remembering forces us to look our mistakes in the face. It's often murky pools holding up a mirror to our hubris. When I went to Hawaii for my year-long internship with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, I did not do any research beforehand. What were the local politics like? The history of the Hawaiian Kingdom? How does tourism affect the economy and livelihoods of local people? What even is Waikiki? I was ignorant, and my privilege to be able to go as ignorant as I was inexcusable. I still wonder to this day whether it was right for me to go to Hawaii. How do I hold this opposition, the intentions of moving there, neither bad nor good, but that doesn't necessarily make it right, versus the lessons I have learned that have forever changed my life? Living in Hawaii forced me to acknowledge my whiteness and my contributions to colonialism in a way I never have before. I was put in my place a couple times by locals, as I was a white outsider representing a federal organization in an overthrown kingdom. And it was well-deserved and needed. I can't change the fact that I moved to Hawaii, and yet I am so grateful for the humblings and all the good it gave me. It was on Kaho'olawe that I learned that the spiritual work is just as important as the physical. We can cut down however many invasive trees and plants as we want, but if we don't first introduce ourselves and who we bring with us, whether physically or spiritually, what does it matter? If we don't set the right intentions for doing the work, how can we breathe life into the new plants that need nurturing? How can we notice what needs the land is crying for or what it's teaching us? This was coming to me at a point in my life when I was drained and burnt out from my years growing up in a conservative evangelical home, church, and college until I transferred out. Constantly being told that men are head of the household, how I should dress and act, that all glory goes to God and I am nothing except without Jesus, and that self-care is a form of self-worship, I took a little hiatus from this endless deconstruction of my childhood faith. Denying individualism and no longer worshiping the productivity of capitalism is an ongoing battle, but having this new, tangible lens of spirituality started planting the seeds for my own rejuvenation. Coming back to Indiana provided me a chance to rediscover this place I call home and form roots and build community as an adult. I started exploring what it means to be Mennonite, which is my whole mother's side of the family. Although I wasn't raised in the Mennonite faith, I knew the stories of my grandfather emigrating from the USSR to escape Russianization, and how my grandparents met in Mexico through MCC during World War II. And through this exploration, I found hospitality to be a meaningful and revitalizing practice and framework in this phase of life. As we know, hospitality is a two-way street as guests and hosts open themselves up to receive new relationships, insights, or other gifts. But the fullness of hospitality also encompasses being good hosts to ourselves and all that we embody. It requires that we challenge ourselves to investigate our biases, as well as give ourselves grace when we've reached our limits. Bringing all I am and who I carry, my ancestors, my values, my stories, means so much more to me now than it did when I chanted in front of Kaho'olawe. It's fascinating to me that I am much closer to my dad's side of the family and personal relationships, who is very much not Mennonite, but have pursued my Mennonite heritage. I swear, every time I go over to my aunt's house, my dad's sister, she always asks me, "So what are Mennonites again?" They see me, a very outspoken, loud, adventurous feminist, and compare that to my mother, the passive-aggressive, quiet, submissive wife and mother. And it doesn't make sense to them, but it's starting to make sense to me. I saw how my mother strived for peace and the way she settled sibling squabbles by talking it out. I witnessed how she made sure everyone was fed when they walked through our doors, soaking in the meaning of food and how it brings people together. I love contradictions, in case you can't tell. And I love finding them in my own beliefs, and especially love pointing them out to members of my family. Much to their frustration, but as a baby of the family, I'm just doing my job. I didn't focus on contradictions as a space to be inhabited and appreciated until a friend made an offhand comment in between classes about how she doesn't believe altruism exists in this world, and that she had to reconcile the fact that humans are contradictory and their selfless acts for selfish gain. And that's okay. I continue to toy with this idea, and I don't know if I agree with her definition of altruism, but gleaning wisdom from the oppositions I find within myself and the community around me has been fun and hard and rewarding. Yet despite the messiness that we bring, hospitality has taught me that we are worthy of redemption. How can we know and experience God authentically and wholly if we don't know ourselves first? So I often think about how to hold contradictions together. Are we meant to hold contradictions together? I think that's what makes us human and an equal part of creation. And this was further enriched when Jeff Hostetler shared some wisdom with me during the beginning of Lent. Salvation is often talked about as a binary, a complete death to the old and turning to the new. But what if it's not? That we aren't meant to say goodbye or completely reject our former selves, the parts that we must acknowledge in order to be whole. What if the contradictions of our lives are not so binary as well, but are instead invitations to begin? Connecting with the Mennonite faith on my mother's side, with the loyal and fierce love of my father's side, has grounded me in so many ways. I was born on my grandparents' anniversary, my dad's parents, and this year I was lucky to share my birthday with Mother's Day and what would have been my grandparents' 74th anniversary. My grandfather passed a couple weeks before May 8, so that day was a messy one for me. But as I let the feelings happen and permitted them to take up space, it felt more like a holy day than the days before. I remained encouraged by the times I received maternal pride from strong role models this past year, just as I was learning to be proud of myself. I replayed the stories and memories from staying with my grandmother that past week. And I held close lives lived, even if they feel lost. I believe learning to grieve is to celebrate, even if celebrating feels aggrieved. And all of these reflected memories I have shared sometimes feels like a flooded pool as I try to make sense of them all together. Other times it feels like a river with a moving direction, and it's comforting to know that it's always the same river, even with different water. But no matter its manifestation, water always responds to the moon for the tide, teaching us to give and take when it's time. I don't know what it's felt like for you to hear these stories, but I'll leave you with this poem by Rainier Maria Rilke, which helped me move forward on my birthday as I grieved and celebrated. I love all beginnings, despite their anxiousness and their uncertainty, which belong to every commencement. I have earned a pleasure or a reward, or if I wish that something had not happened, if I doubt the worth of an experience and remain in my past, then I choose to begin at this very second. Begin what? I begin. I have already thus begun 1,000 lives.